Well, thank you. I thought you might. Now, what's behind you?
That, believe it or not, is almost the view from one of our bedroom windows. It's Peel Castle in the background. It goes back to beyond Stone Age, actually. But the castle goes back to about 1200 and something. The little part sticking up there with the hole in it is the remains of a chapel, which was the original cathedral on the Isle of Man. But it's where St. Patrick landed when he came to the island, I guess, on his way to Great Britain to do all of his converting and reforming. So it's quite a historical place. That beach in the background is where the Vikings landed when they first came here.
So did St. Patrick flush out all the snakes from the Isle of Man?
Sorry, he was what?
I'm sorry, I said, did he flush out all the snakes from the Isle of Man?
Gee, that's a good question. He probably did. I don't know if there are any snakes here. I've never seen any.
Well, Alan, we have actually, I think, only been together one time, which was in 2010 when you published the sequel to The Sweetness at the Bottom of the Pie.
That's right. It's been 10 years. It's hard to believe, isn't it?
It is hard to believe. But what's interesting to me, I mean, among all the other things that I like about you, is that after you published that book, you are Canadian, but you and your wife surely have embarked upon international living. So after I'm trying to remember which book it was, but anyway, you moved to Malta. And particularly to Gozo, which is one of the three islands, and then you didn't come to visit us anymore.
That's right. We were a long way away at that time, and travel was just very long and very difficult from Malta because you had to get there by way of Germany, and I forget how I got to your place. I think it was by way of Germany and New York City. And all the way out to Arizona, you were as far west as I went on the book tour, which was absolutely memorable. I remember vividly the poison pen and the staff and how good they were with a guy that was sort of jet lagged and burned out. And they were also interesting to talk to. I was treated sort of like a visiting royalty there. And it was a wonderful stop on a very long trip. I think I did something like 25 cities in a month.
Well, you know what? You were visiting royalty, no question about it, because you had such a smash hit with your first book. But let me pursue this for a minute. I mean, you're Canadian, you grew up in Eastern Canada, but then after you retired, or actually not after you retired, you moved west. And then you lived in Kelowna, which interestingly, or Kelowna, I don't know how to pronounce it, which is where our software people operate, because we have software called Book Manager, and that's their headquarters, which is where? Somewhere in British Columbia. Is it near Vancouver?
No, it's in the interior of BC. It's in the Okanagan Valley, which runs right up the middle of BC. It's a very, very, very beautiful valley with a lot of fruit growing and an absolutely wonderful climate there. It never gets very cold in the BC interior. And we were retired there for about 10 years, actually. Somebody had told me once that if you wrote a novel, it would take 10 years to get it published. And I think it took 15. Wow. But we were there until I think it was 2008, roughly. And then we moved to Malta and lived on the little farming island of Gozo off the coast of Malta, which was a whole different experience. But I think the second book, The Weed That Strings the Hangman's Bag, was written mostly in Gozo. I think I had started it when we moved there, but I definitely finished it there. And it was just after that that I came to visit you.
Well, I've been to Malta and Gozo. Actually, I've been to Malta more than once because, you know, it's, if you're doing any kind of travel in the Mediterranean, it has a very strategic position. It's an ancient culture there and was a key part of the British Empire when it was controlling Gibraltar, Malta, and then Suez. So it's a fascinating place to visit. But the real question is, at the age of 70, because that's about what you were, why in the world did you move away from Canada to Gozo?
Oh, I don't know, foolhardiness, I guess. Partly because my wife and I had both had worked for our lifetime in jobs where our superiors were always sent on trips to London or Paris or Rome or something like that. And we were usually stuck with going to Tesco for coffee. That was the kind of outing you got. And we thought, well, we have the opportunity and we're able to travel still. And so we thought, why not? I think everybody thought that we were mad to do that, but we had quite an adventure. We lived there for I think it was about 5 years or so, and at that point it became quite difficult to remain there because as Canadian citizens we were not EU citizens, and there are a lot of restrictions on everything. If you're not an EU citizen, you can't do this and you can't do that. And eventually it became, you sort of wear out your welcome on constantly renewing visitor permits. And it becomes more difficult at each stage. And we finally realized that we were not going to be able to stay there long term. And so we started doing some traveling. We went to some wonderful places, including the Isle of Man, and as soon as we saw it, we said, that's where we want to live. And so we have, it's sort of an unsuspected spot. I don't know if anybody knows how beautiful it is. It looks a lot like Ireland. It's sort of a mixture of Ireland and the English Lake District. And the incredible beauty of the place, when we travel into the big city, which is about 9 miles from here, and it's about a 40-minute bus ride to go into the big city. And even after the eight years that we've been here, we still just goggle at the scenery on the way in. It's so beautiful with the rolling hills and covered with sheep. They have their own type of very specialized rare sheep that they raise here that are dotted all over the hills and the streams and the green hills, and absolutely stunning. So we thought this was a great place to be, and it has a wonderful history, and there have been a lot of writers who lived here too.
Well, I think of it, well, let me start over here. For those who don't know the Isle of Man, it's in the Irish Sea. It's west of Britain, but part of Britain, because Alan and I thrashed out over getting our time zones right. It was brought to my attention some years ago because it's the home of the world famous motorcycle race rally. Yes. And so we were prepared to come and visit you, Alan. And then I discovered how really hard it is to get to the Isle of Man, unless you have, you know, you can fly, but then the weather may do you in. And there's ferry, I'm trying to remember, there's one maybe from Liverpool and one from, do I have it right, Hexham or some such place?
Yeah, I think at the moment there are no flights from here because the island is sealed off from the outside world. But in normal days, there are flights to Liverpool, Manchester, Birmingham, and London, and occasionally to Dublin. And that's about it.
Right. Well, I think that we were going to visit you with Diana Gabaldon and her husband, who's a motorcycle enthusiast, and they were going to fly in from Dublin, and we were going to come by ferry from Liverpool, but then I don't even remember how it all didn't work out. But part of the problem was that because it's an island and because of weather, if you got there and the weather went bad and you had another obligation, you might not be able to get off. So anyway, I still would love to come. And I think it's fabulous that you live there. I wasn't sure if being Canadian in the pandemic, if you needed to go back to Canada, because here in Scottsdale, where we have so many Canadian winter visitors, they all had to go back to Canada in March and be quarantined there in order for the Canadian Health Service to cover them.
We're not allowed to go back to Canada now because we're resident outside of Canada. And there's a certain timeline if you've been away from Canada for more than, I think it's 3 years or something, you can't claim to be repatriated. You can't go back home again until the borders are reopened. But since our residence is here, we don't have any immediate need to go back to Canada. So I don't foresee that in the near future anyway.
I think it's so interesting that given all of this, do you pronounce it Flavia or Flavia?
Flavia.
Okay, so Flavia actually lives in a decaying British manor, or at least that's how we met her, called Buckshaw, in a small village in the 1950s. And when you wrote that, you'd never been to Britain.
No, I hadn't. It was sort of a distillation of everything that I had ever read. Growing up in a very British expat household where all of the reading was British reading matter, and everything was oriented towards that. So I grew up on good English books. When my grandmother used to press novels on me to read when I was just a kid, because I was quite an early reader, and one of the books I vividly remember her giving me was Dorothy Sayers' Busman's Honeymoon.
Which is a lovely book. Although personally, I've always liked The Nine Tailors. Most people really love Gaudy Night just because, you know, it's so exotic in a sense. But I've actually gone to bell ringing the changes when I've traveled in England and, you know, had like a nostalgic Sayers moment.
Right. Yeah, it's very nice. We've been in Oxford several times. I've been invited to speak at Oxford at a conference there. And we've actually stood on Magdalen Bridge and listened to the change ringing just below the point where Lord Peter proposed to Harriet. And it really connects when you're right there with your feet on the riverbank. At that point, it just makes all of those books come so much alive all over again. I mean, you thought they were great the first time you read them, but after standing in Oxford and breathing the air and seeing those colleges and the river and everything, you just have to go back and read them all over again. But I agree, I was going to say The Nine Tailors is my all-time favorite mystery by any author, including Conan Doyle.
Well, that is remarkable. I'm delighted to know we bond over that, as we have over so many things. I took myself to Oxford for a whole summer at Worcester College in order to do it. I, a Stanford graduate, had to enroll at the University of California, Berkeley, which is like the deadly rivalry between the two universities. So I still have 3 hours of graduate credit at Berkeley. But anyway, I got to spend a whole summer at Worcester College and, you know, do all those things. But what I found my most Sayers moment, in a way, was St. Hilda's College, which is an all-women's college at Oxford, has hosted a crime conference for many years in the summer. And I went there one summer, I've gone several times, when Laurie King was there. And Laurie took me out on the river in a punt and, you know, punted me up and down. So it wasn't quite the undergraduate experience where I was a young lady with a white dress and a hat with ribbons and holding champagne and some handsome young Oxford undergraduate was hauling me up and down the river. But somehow doing it with Laurie, who's pretty magnificent pulling, was even more fun. So I think Dorothy Sayers would have approved.
Yeah, St. Hilda's is marvelous, isn't it? I went there, the first time I went there, I was seated at the head table across from Colin Dexter. And I spent the entire evening being able to chat with him about the Inspector Morse series. And he wound up giving me an autographed page of one of the television scripts.
Wow, that is wonderful. I have to say, I really love Inspector. I liked Inspector Lewis. And in a way, I like Inspector Lewis. I liked it better because Morse has now died and those people are moving forward. When you watch Endeavor, and I love Sean Evans, sadly, yeah. None of his relationships will work out. Everything will eventually come to grief because he's moving towards Morse, you know, from the ones written by Dexter. So I found this last one rather sad in that respect, because you can see that Thursday is going to get left behind at some point if it's going to continue. But anyway, let's not talk about Morse. Let's talk about Flavia. And I love her origin story. You know, I think it's so interesting that two of the biggest mystery sensations of the last two decades have been Flavia, written by you, and Gamache, written by Louise Penny. Both of you Canadian, both of you writing really quirky characters and unusual plots. But what's really fun is that, and you should tell this story, not me, that it was Louise who alerted you to the debut dagger contest and really thus kind of was a midwife for Flavia.
That's right. It was actually, there were three of us involved. There was Louise, and there was my wife, Shirley, and there was me, who was sort of the beneficiary of all this. But it was quite an odd story, because Shirley is an avid quilter. And in our retirement home, she had a very nice quilting studio that she had built. And she liked to be in there alone, or alone in there with one of the cats, and just be away from a world where she could think. And I kept saying, why don't you get a radio to listen to? You could listen to CBC Radio. They have such great talk programs on there. And she said no, she wasn't interested. So she quilted on for, I don't know, a couple of years anyway. And then one day she said to me, I think I'd like a radio in the quilting studio. And so I had a sort of little portable shortwave multi-band radio, and I took it in for her, and she had it tuned to CBC. And lo and behold, Sheila Rogers, who is Canada's top interviewer, Sheila is interview royalty in Canada and a wonderful person. And Sheila was interviewing Louise Penny, and Louise was talking about being shortlisted for the debut Dagger Award in the UK, which was operated by the Crime Writers Association, which is a very old and distinguished organization of crime writers. And Louise wound up by giving instructions specifically on how to enter this thing. She said, you can do it online. And so Shirley wrote all of this down, and she came into the next room where I was working at the computer, and she gave me the web address and everything for the debut Dagger, and she said, you have to do this, you have to enter this. And oddly enough, I had been writing another mystery at that time, which I thought was really good, and I said, I'll send that. And Shirley said, no, you'll send Flavia, you have to send Flavia. And of course I knew better, so I said, no, I'm going to send the one about the girl working for the television studio. And Shirley said, no, you're going to send Flavia. And I only had 15 pages of it or so done at that time, but that was all they required. I think it was I think it was 15,000 words that you had to have, or something like that. And I sent it in, and then quite a long time went by. And I was out one day, I was out doing the secondhand bookshops, and I came home and Charlie said, oh, there was a phone call for you. And it was the Crime Writers Association to say that the book had won, or the 15 pages had won the Debut Dagger Award. And so I had to go to England, which I had never done before. I'd never been there. I didn't even own a passport. So we had to drive through the mountains in the rain to Vancouver and get a passport and get on the plane and go to England to the Park Lane Hotel where this big fancy dinner and presentation was held. And things have never been the same since. It was a total change of lifestyle.
That's wonderful. So it started you off on your travel, because actually you have to have a passport in order to do that.
Yeah, I
belong to the CWA since 1990, actually. I think it's a great organization, and their Debut Dagger program, which is a great way for aspiring authors to get attention, whether you win or whether you're a runner-up. The Daggers are one of the older mystery awards. And in fact, your Flavia won the Arthur Ellis Award, which is Canada's version of the Daggers, the American version of the Edgar Allan Poe Awards, and the Australian version of the Ned Kelly Awards. I love the fact that the Australians honor an outlaw and the Canadians honor their hangman. I mean, the Arthur Ellis Award. So who was it I talked to recently that showed me, because he had it with him. When we had a conversation, I didn't realize, because I hadn't actually seen it, that the Arthur Ellis Award really is the hangman.
It is a hanged man, yeah. I understand they've stopped doing that now.
Huh.
So I wouldn't say one of the few. I can see it from where I'm sitting, but it is a hanged man that has a little string that you can pull on. He kind of goes like that. It's a sort of morbid, but it's a lot of fun. And it's an honor to have won that in my own country. I think quite often you can win foreign awards and it doesn't seem like very much in Canada. So to win that and win the Agatha in the US and the Debut Dagger in the UK is probably one of the great reasons why the Flavia books have sold in something like 38 countries now.
Yes, I saw that. 38 countries and probably almost as many languages, 36 or something. But 36. Yes, you also won the McCavity Award and the Dulles Award, which at that point there really was a Mystery Booksellers Association in the United States. And the Dulles Award was named for Dulles Wynn, who was a very early mystery bookseller. So he really scooped up a great many things for Flavia. And I was impressed that, you know, you were able after that great start, because sometimes the second novel is hard to do after you've had a sensational debut novel. But you did bring out, what is it, The Weed That Strings the Hangman's Bag in 2010. And you've gone on to the most recent one is, trying to remember the whole title, Golden Tresses, I know is part of it.
Golden Tresses of the Dead. Yeah.
And that was in 2019. So how many altogether now, Flavius?
Golden Tresses of the Dead was the 10th book that I'd written in 10 years. I did a book a year for 10 years. And I was very proud to have done that. I think all of them were on the New York Times bestseller list over the years. And there was a point where I was thinking I'd better quit while I'm ahead.
Yeah, but it's hard to let her go. Although, you know, it's interesting when you have a sleuth that is so young. I mean, part of the fun of Flavia was that she was that great age, what, 11, I think, right, when we first met her. So she was no longer really a child, but she was far from being an adult. In fact, not even a teenager. And so inevitably, unless you froze her, she was going to get older. And things were going to have to change. You gave her an interesting family, a missing mother, and, you know, a father burdened down by this and that, and Wicked Sisters and so forth. And in one book, I think the 2016 book, you brought her, maybe earlier one, but anyway, you brought her over to Canada to put her in boarding school. That didn't work out for long, so she went back to England. But so you've had to, you know, age her. But how old was she in the Golden Tresses? How much have we moved along with her?
Very roughly, the books have been about 3 or 4 months apart. So the first one was in 1950. So the fourth one would have been getting on into 1950-51. And at the 10th book, we were into about the middle of 1952, roughly. So Flavia went from being almost 11 to, although she hasn't specifically mentioned it, she doesn't often talk about her age. I think she played on it a bit in the early book because she was so young, but she's very coy about certain things. And as she gets a little closer to being a grown up or even a teenager, she's a little bit evasive about it, and she doesn't confide in me anything about her age at all. She doesn't point out either that she's a young marvel or that she's a not very experienced adult.
But I think one of her fascinating features is the fact that, you know, in some ways she's super smart. I mean, she's a real prodigy, but in other ways, you know, she's still a child, still naive about some things, and certain adult judgment. But you know, in The Sweetness of the Bottom of the Pie, her first book, while many children would have been appalled to have run across a dead body, she thought it was fabulous, the most interesting thing that had happened. Right. So you know, and she's a chemistry experimenter and all the rest of it. So I thought your choice of her age was brilliant, because you got to do so much with it. Is that based in part upon your long career as a screenwriter? Because when you retired, you know, you wrote a lot of screenplays.
Right. No, I don't think I ever thought about that. It was just that Flavia came as a voice, that she just started talking to me. And it worked the other way around. I didn't know who she was. I had to sort of pry that out of her over a very long period of time, maybe 6 months. And all I knew was that this voice was speaking through my fingers, and I needed to write it down and don't ask too many questions. It was an exercise in listening rather than trying to enforce myself, because I knew at that point I was probably a lot stronger than she was, and I would be able to influence her badly, that she would become a miniature Alan Bradley or something like that, which would not have won any awards. So I learned very early just to listen to her and don't try to judge her, but try to find out, as if I were a detective trying to extract all of this information about who she was. And I just wrote and let her tell what she wanted to. There were lots of things she didn't tell me and still hasn't told me, but I've never pressed her about it. I've never tried to impose a scene that would make her reveal something just out of my own personal curiosity. She tells me what she wants to tell me. But and I did know very early that because she was an 11-year-old girl, that she was an ideal detective because she was invisible.
Yes. No, I saw that maybe it was in 2015, you gave a lecture to the Baker Street Irregulars. And I thought there was, you know, they were so useful to Sherlock Holmes, you know, they were able to go around and do things in London for Holmes in under sort of a cloak of invisibility based on youth.
Exactly.
And so forth. And so I could see that Flavio would would benefit from the same thing because people would discount her because they thought of her as a child. But her family, you know, is really interesting and have their own agenda and backstories that are difficult. So did you, Flavia may speak to you, but did you create the family more than, I mean, did they speak to you or did you think them up?
No, I think they came with her, although there is probably some truth in that. Somebody asked me once, Flavia doesn't have sisters that are so many years older than her because you had two sisters who were that amount older than you were. And I always say, oh, no, not at all, not at all. But I did have two older sisters, one who was 8 years older and one who was 10 years older. And some of the things that they did to me, I won't even begin to describe in a book. I mean, it would be banned.
Right, for, well, you don't need to expose your deep family secrets, but I do think, you know, part of the charm of the series, and it's true, I think with almost all series, except possibly Jack Reacher, is the ensemble cast that develops. People get attached to not just the lead character, but other characters. And actually an interesting discussion, I'm trying to think who it was, with Kyle Mills, a completely different writer, you know, international thriller writer, and Brad Thor, Monday night when we launched Kyle's book, about maybe a spinoff with one of the characters who is a girl. And I think that's an interesting thing too, that a character in a novel can cry out to become the lead in a book of his or her own.
Yeah, did you have any older sisters?
No, I am the oldest in my family. You and I are among the very senior people in the mystery world. You're just slightly older than I am. But I have a younger sister, now deceased tragically, and I have a brother who is younger at age 7. And I do think it's really true that your place in your family often determines much about you. And also how your family develops. My brother, because I was born in 1940, so there was still the wartime austerity thing, which you're familiar with. But my brother was born in 1947 when my father had forged ahead in his career, always had affluence. You know, he never had to experience the kinds of restrictions. And I remember desperately wanting to go away to camp with a very good friend when I was like in the second grade. And my parents at that point couldn't afford to send me. And that's an experience my brother never had. You know, they were able to afford whatever he wanted. And I mean, I'm not complaining, it all worked out, but it really is true that where you are in your family, where you are in your parents' lives, and whether you're the eldest or the middle or younger or whatever it is, often have a big effect on who you become.
Yeah, and it seems to me that the greater the separation in years, the stronger the effect is. When you have 8 and 10 years between children, there's an enormous tension in interest and probably behavior, because by the time I don't even remember how old I was, but by the time I was 5, my sister was in high school, and my oldest sister, and had boyfriends. And I was so far removed from that. I mean, I was in kindergarten at that time, and I was still at the stage where they used to tie me up with nylon stockings to keep me out of their courting activities. So there was a certain amount of Flavia's ability to escape from slip knots behind her back based on that personal experience of having two older sisters who had wonderfully black senses of humor and did the most horrendous things to me, that it took us probably 50 years to be able to laugh about it.
Well, you know, let's look at it this way, it enriched your life as a writer. So, you know, nothing wasted. But yeah, I'm sure your books would be different. Maybe Flavia wouldn't even exist if you
hadn't. That's right. Yeah. No, I realize that I probably owe a lot of that to my early life and my sisters. I actually wrote a book about that was published and then republished a couple of years ago as an ebook. It was called The Shoebox Bible. And it was really a book about my mother, about having bringing up three kids during the war with no husband. And I put a lot in that book about the dynamic with being the youngest of three children and having two older and very, very creative sisters. But the book kind of fell through the cracks. I think people thought it was a religious book, or they thought that it was sort of a fundamentalist type. Somebody said to me once, pity about the B word in the title.
Isn't that interesting? You know, that this comes up all the time. We've done hundreds, actually. We found out not recently, we found some old videotapes and realized that our very first recorded interview on video was in 1995 with P.D. James. And when we did it, she made me promise that we would never show it during her lifetime. But now that we found it, and sadly she's no longer with us, Rob, who in the pandemic, my husband, has become an audio and video engineer, has gone back, and I think there are like 150 at least video interviews from 1995 on up. But anyway, as we keep doing this, one of the questions that constantly comes up is, how are writers coping in the pandemic? Is it making them more prolific because they have more time? Is it so distracting that it's too hard to write? Is everybody dodging the pandemic because we don't know how it's going to come out? So anything you might say would be at this point purely speculative. So are you in fact working on anything?
Yes and no. There have been a lot of interest in having a new Flavia book. I intentionally took a break after the 10th one. I realized that I needed some time to myself and that I needed time for my tanks to fill up, as Mark Twain said. And so I took 2 years off and I didn't do any writing at all. Although Flavia has never been far from my thoughts. I mean, she talks to me at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning and says, get up and write this down. I have an idea about this or that. Or I read something in a book and Flavia will make a comment. You better jot that down. We need that or we can use that. And there's been a certain amount of pressure, I guess, from readers and from publishers to you better get going because you're 82.
Well, I think, you know, it's great for you to take some time for yourself. People are always asking me if I'm ever going to retire. My general answer is, what would I do? I just don't think retirement would suit me. But you know, I had a senior moment because when I started off that thing about how far back our videos go, what I meant to say in part was that one of the most frequent questions that has come up over the however long that's been, 25 years or something, is about titles. You know, does the author get to choose the title? No, it's really the publisher has to approve it, on and on. And there's some really fascinating stories about titles, ones that miss the mark, ones that are perfect. And so, you know, your comment about the Bible falls into that whole thing. Maybe calling it something else or just saying a memoir, you know, would have a different effect.
Yeah. The titles are so important. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Flavia books have been successful is because the titles are long and weird.
Yes. And, you and Lee Burke in The Electric Mist of the Confederate Dead Till You Came Along was my personal favorite title. And, you know, I thought, how do you get away with that? And then, you know, all of your titles have been amazing. And I think if Flavia hadn't been so incredibly successful with The Sweetness at the Bottom of the Pie, you would never have been allowed to do that. But, you know, it was a winning formula going out, and so nobody really messed with it.
Right. Well, in that case, the title came before the book, because quite a few years before that, my wife and I had been at it wasn't a grad sale, it was a lawn sale, and they had a box full of books and dictionaries and encyclopedias, and Shirley bought me I think it's a 3 or 4 volume dictionary that was published in 1896. And it was one of those wonderful dictionaries that gives you original sources or examples of the words as they're defined. And I used to love browsing through those great big, huge, heavy volumes, and would quite often take them to the bathroom with me, if I might say so. And I was looking in the first volume, and it just fell open at the word crinkle. And it just stopped my eye completely. And I said, what a nice word, crinkle. I haven't heard anybody say crinkle for years and years and years. We should rehabilitate it. And the example that was given for it was a quote from William King on a book of cookery, which was written entirely in verse in the 15 or early 1600s. And his quote to illustrate the use of the word was, unless some sweetness at the bottom lie, who cares for all the crinkling of the pie? And as soon as I saw it, I said, that's a title. That's a title right there, The Sweetness at the Bottom of the Pie. And then I forgot about it for years. And it was actually when I was well into the Flavia book, after I got back from receiving the Debut Dagger Award, I didn't even have a title at that point. And I suddenly realized one day as I was writing, hey, I'm writing The Sweetness at the Bottom of the Pie. And so the title just merged with the book. And it was quite interesting because the publisher said, you can't have that title. It's way too long. People will never remember it. They'll hate it. It has too many words. And it's unclear. It doesn't form a particular idea. But we somehow argued. I don't know if I was stubborn or whether they just decided to be nice to me because I was so elderly. But they kept the title. And then the second one, The Weed That Strings the Hangman's Bag, they said, no, you have to cut that down. It's way too long and too obscure and everything. And we said, well, we insisted on the first one, so we'll insist on the second one. And then they started to become very proud of them. They thought these are identifiable because they're so long. Everybody knows it's a Flavia Deluce book because it has a long, convoluted, weird, and intriguing title. But all of them have been things that have just jumped out at me in my own reading. I can be plowing through books about anything, and these phrases just come right off the page, and I know that's my next title.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that the titles that, you know, fit the books, there's a whole personality. You know, it's a branding thing almost, you know, it's a Flavia Deluce book if it has this title. Now, I was thinking about crinkling while you were talking. You know, I think it's no longer used because we moved from cellophane to plastic. Cellophane crinkled. And plastic does not. Anyway, there we are, etymology. This has been so much fun to spend some time with you, Alan. I'm not sure whether you'll get to see us or we'll finally make it to the Isle of Man. It seems terrible not to have a reunion after 10 years, that's too long.
Yeah, well, I hope you do. They canceled the TT races this year, but they're apparently on next year. And anybody who's watching, they always ask about the TT races. If you haven't seen them, go to YouTube and do a search on the TT races. And if you like the idea of grown men driving motorcycles at 200 miles an hour through narrow, narrow, narrow village streets and lanes, you won't believe it. It's absolutely, it's no wonder people come from all over the world to see it. But I haven't actually seen it myself because I stay at home when it's on.
Well, believe it. You know what? At my age, I'm thinking that maybe I'd rather just come when it's quiet and not have to battle my way through throngs and see how it goes. But this has really been delightful, Alan. Thank you for spending time with me today.
Well, thanks. It's great to be with you again, and I hope we'll meet in person before too long.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.